Hey everyone, welcome back to Drive On. I'm your host, Scott DeLuzio, and today my guest is Christopher Maher. At the age of 22, he was a Navy SEAL and one of the fittest people on the planet. But despite his peak physical condition, he struggled with the impact of stress on his physical, mental, and emotional well-being. And through a journey of relentless self-exploration and healing, he developed a comprehensive system for total physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual healing and integration. And we're going to talk about that and how service members and veterans can learn from these experiences in just a minute. But before we get into that, Christopher, I want to welcome you to the show. I'm really glad to have you here.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here in the show serving, man.
Yeah, absolutely. And so
with a fellow veteran.
Likewise. I'm glad to have you here. And I feel like, you know, anytime I have veterans on the show, which is, you know, quite frequently, you know, you and I started talking a little bit before we started recording here, spoken in person prior to this. But it's almost like there's this instant connection between veterans. You start to, you know, just have that kind of commonality and different bonds, you know, maybe different branches of service, but there's still some shared connection there. And, you know, we kind of just start flowing with the conversation pretty naturally. So, but let's get back into your story here. I'd like to start maybe by talking about your journey from being a Navy SEAL to your current work and with what you do now.
Oh, that's like, that's a very open question.
Well, I like to keep it open, you know, so that way you can kind of flow with it how you want.
You know, my journey in the military is unique because I lost my mom when I was 7 years old. She committed suicide. And at the time, there was, you know, this is 1976, so there was no concept of mental wellness. And she had an event that occurred where someone broke her boundaries, and she was a very sort of righteous person and moral. So she started sharing all over town what happened, and she got put into a psych ward, and they gave her electric shock therapy until she agreed that that didn't occur. And sign some paperwork. And so so I was growing up underneath her care. And she was very interesting because she was a bit militant, right? But then she would flip into like super, super sweet and then back to really militant. And I didn't know at the time, you know, she was attempting to protect me. And she was doing this from a place of love and care. All I knew is I was scared of my mom. Like, you didn't ever want to do anything wrong around her. And so after she died, I bounced around in foster care for a while. And I think after about seven and a half months, I got an opportunity to go to boarding school. And, you know, the name of the school is Milton Hershey School. And Milton Hershey School is run a bit like the military in the sense that you wake up the same time every day. So it was the later parts of school, I was waking up at 5:30 every morning, going to barn, working super hard, you know, getting back into the house by like 7:15. 7. Eating breakfast at 7:15 to 7:30, cleaning up dishes from 7:30 to 7:45, getting ready for school from 7:45 to 8 o'clock. And at 8 o'clock, you better be in a van or the van leaves without you to go to school. And then you've got to walk, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10 miles. And so I had already had that military training. And, you know, they're checking your bed every day. Like, you remember boot camp, right?
Oh, yeah.
They're checking the corners on your bed. So when I went to boot camp was kind of like a joke for me because I'd already had 10 years of that. Like, I'm have to create perfect creases and corners on my bed at 7 years old,
right?
You know? So I think that training in my younger years really helped me cope in the military, helped me, know how to relate to guys, and you know, how to find your place within a group. Because that can be difficult if you don't know how to do that. If you grow in a household, it's just like you, your mom, and your dad, and your brother, and that's it. You know, how do you learn how to fit in with like 15 or 16 different people? And, you know, regardless of the branch that you're in, you're always broken up into smaller groups.
Yeah.
And so, you know, boot camp was in Great Lakes. I was in the Navy. Obviously, you have to be in the Navy to become a Navy SEAL.
Sure.
But there is a little caveat there that if you, they have the Naval Special Warfare Center, but that belongs to JSOC. And if you were a Marine or you were an Army Ranger or Green Beret, you could get the opportunity to enter into BUDS and to go through training. And BUDS, I loved BUDS. Like, you wake up, you're working out all day, right? You're eating, and then you're, you know, you're, some guys are going out and they're partying, and some guys are going right to bed. I was one of those guys that kept really a low profile in SEAL training, as low as a profile as I can. You know, like, you're, most of the guys in SEAL training are white. You know, it's just like every other class, there's like one Latino, and then there's, you know, every like third or fourth class, there's one African American, right? So it's a different, you know, it's like, it's a different vibe. And I liked it, right? Like, I like pushing myself. I like being challenged. But I was very lean. And what I mean by that is I had very little body fat. And so we had these long ocean swims, and we had at the time what they referred to as surf torture. So you got to lock, arms, walk into the ocean, you know, to your about, you know, hip deep, and then sit down and let the cold waves crash over and over and over again in your head, and make sure you, you know, keep your arms close together. Because if you break that chain, they're going to pull you out of the water. They're going to turn you into a sand cookie. You got to roll around in sand. And, you know, and I was someone who, I was on the spectrum, right? And so, you know, when you're on the spectrum, everything for you is heightened. It's much more sensitive, right? Your smell is much more sensitive, your skin, fabric touching you. And so when I was a child, I could never play in the sandbox with all the other kids, because all those other textures, I couldn't calm down. They just freaked me out. It was just too much. It was just like sensory overload. And so here I am, like, a person who's on the spectrum, and I'm in this environment where I've got all these intense textures against my body. So in a certain way, it numbed me out from all that high sensitivity that I was having with my smell, with my hearing, with my vision, my touch, with taste. And I got through SEAL training. It was a lot of work. I had a very unique path because they had misdiagnosed me as a probable epileptic. So I had to go through this 6-month process and being retested, you know, taking this doctor who's an officer to court to plead my case to show that he was negligent in the way that he was going about what he was doing. And then, you know, I had to go to a physical evaluation board. So getting through SEAL training was like, it wasn't, I just showed up, I worked out hard, and then I would graduate. Like, it was full of challenges.
Sure.
The hypothermia was a challenge. I had full-blown hypothermia. Like, a bunch of times I got hospitalized for ventricular fibrillation, which is a heart attack. Then I fell off the slide for life in SEAL training. I got rolled back, and it was a thing. And then me and a second phase instructor, you know, he sort of had it out for me for some silly reason, and he was going to make it almost impossible for me to graduate. And I had to work through that. So me getting through SEAL training was an absolute miracle. And then getting to the SEAL teams was like kind of easy. And then, you know, I, oh, this is funny. We went to celebrate our graduation from advanced version of training that you go through before you receive your trident and become a SEAL team member. And I was one of the guys that didn't drink. So I was with my class, we're out at a bar, they're having fun. And then it's time to go. And now these guys are like trying to start a street fight with us. I just go over to cops and go, look, man, there's these clowns over here. We all just graduated from SEAL training. These guys are trying to cause a ruckus. We just want to go back and get out of here. Can you come sort this out? He was like, turn around, put your hands behind your back. And I was like, whoa, dude, I'm trying to de-escalate the situation. And you want to put me behind bars? Like, this is weird. So one of my guys, while he was over there dealing with it, snuck in, got me out of the cop car. I'm running down the street with my hands behind my back. come around a corner, I'm hiding in bushes. I got white pants on and a white shirt. And I'm like, this isn't going to work. And I come out, police come around a corner, toss me on the hood, slam my head down. It was just like a whole mess. So showing up at SEAL Team 5, right? They're like, my first day I'm showing up, leaving jail. And they're like, who's this dude? So I had a very interesting entrance into the SEAL teams.
This dude's one who's willing to take one for the team, apparently.
Yeah, I took one for the team. And yeah, and then, you know, you get fined. I had to go to court. Just all this silly. Of course, the case got dismissed. But
sure.
But somehow, you know, through the grace of God, you know, I was meant to graduate and go through these things. And mm-hmm. I think all of it made me a better person. But I'm very resilient. And I don't really take no for an answer. Like, I will figure out a way. I'm like a slippery eel. Like, I'll figure out how to get out of the grip of what you're trying to hold me into to get to the place where I really want to be.
Okay.
And, you know, SEAL training was powerful in the sense that I had a rite of passage, you know, and I didn't have a father growing up. And so I had men that I looked up to that, you know, were hard by the process of SEAL training and the SEAL teams. And when I walked across that stage, I felt like a man, felt like I was in charge of my own destiny. Yeah. So
that got you through, that got you into the SEAL teams, right? So yeah. you're doing that. How long were you in the SEALs?
I was in the military for 8 years and 3 months, and then the Naval Special Warfare Community from 1990 to 1997.
Okay. So you get through all that. Once when training is over, once when BUDS is over, that's not it though, right? There's ongoing training. It's a stressful job to have, right?
Yeah, 1,000%. And when you're young, you know, you're adding to that stress because you're trying to figure out how to manage stress. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're in school, I went to college. So you hear this framework. There's two types of stress. There's positive stress, which they call eustress, and negative stress, which they call distress. And I don't think at the time that I was realizing that the job had positive stress, but also negative stress.
Okay.
Right. And I didn't realize it at the time. They weren't talking about complex stress or post-traumatic stress or the effects of stress and how that might show up, the symptoms that you could look at or read about to see if you were under complex stress. And so I was not the person who was a drinker. And then when I got into the SEAL teams, I was managing my stress with alcohol.
Oh.
And I didn't even know it. I just thought, all right, we work hard and we play harder. That was the motto, right? Like, work hard, really play hard.
Sure.
And, you know, I think I took on that identity and I took it a little too far. Right. And it wasn't something I planned, you know, but I just enjoyed having fun. It was like, I was confident. I was strong. I was direct. I was feeling good. And, you know, there was a social environment. San Diego is a great place because everybody's laid back and chill. So I just wanted to chill. And I was never the type of person who had a drink at home, ever. But when I went and I socialized, I dove into what everybody was doing. I just didn't know that there was a cost.
And how did you see this cost kind of develop over time? Like, obviously the environment that you were in kind of led you to coping this way through, yeah, you know, drinking and partying and doing all that kind of stuff. Right. But over time, you know, maybe doing that once or twice, it's not such a big deal, but over time, as that kind of builds and builds and builds, it becomes a bigger deal. And how did you see that kind of, did that deteriorate your mental state, your physical state, you know, and yeah, how did you see that manifest?
I think the way that it manifested for me is I became careless in my relationships. And I wasn't communicating to anyone what I was going through.
Sure.
So if I had pain in my body, even if I had something as silly as a headache, I kept all of those kinds of things that I was dealing with internally to myself. And I think it generated internal isolation.
Okay.
Which made it difficult for whoever I was in relationship with to really connect to what was going on with me. And then, you know, when you become careless in a relationship, you're not communicating, it begins to deteriorate.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I think the foundation of any relationship is going to be good communication. And that's more than just, you know, a marriage or a partnership in that sense, but like any good relationship, it could be a working relationship. There's got to be some communication, even, you know, even in the SEAL teams, if you're not communicating with each other, that's going to be a problem. You know, if you don't know what's going on, you know, a battlefield or something like that, that's a big problem, right?
Yeah. I think communication in the SEAL teams, probably like all military thing, communication is top down. Mm-hmm. And so if you're at the bottom of the rung and you're just getting into the SEAL team, your communication doesn't really have any value. Because there's guys that are hardened vets that have been, you know, they've been on 6 or 7 or 8 deployments. So my first introduction to my platoon, my first platoon, was you're a new guy, an FNG, a fucking new guy, and I better never hear your voice, which meant you're here to sit back and learn.
Yeah, for
how
sure.
How to conduct yourself as a SEAL.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so I was like, okay. I thought it was going to be like SEAL training in a sense. Like, I got my buddies, we're all in the same class, we're having a good time together, we're learning together. It was like, no, you're on the bottom of the rung and we don't give a shit. You're here to learn and you shut your mouth and you learn how to be an operator.
Yeah, so how did you find that you handled this? You know, obviously,
I didn't cope with that well at all.
Not well at all.
No, because I have a very strong, well-defined ego.
Okay.
And if I have to sit like the quiet guy in the corner, right, then it's just not my personality to be that way. You know, my personality is to be fun and funny and to joke around. But now there's this hierarchical, you know, strategy in front of me, and I didn't know how to navigate that successfully.
Right.
Right. And so then I would just start meeting up with guys that were in my class that were on the West Coast and go hang out with them.
Okay. Yeah. So you kind of eliminate that top down
issue
altogether.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Eliminate that. But then when you go on deployment, you know, of course, there's a couple guys that were that are in my class that are in different platoons that are on the same base. And then you find, you know, one or two guys in your platoon that you can kind of relate with. But it's always your first platoon, you always feel like you're you're somehow second tier,
mm-hmm.
right? There's no real space to like spread your wings.
Right.
And so I just said, look, I'm just going to figure out how to operate better than these guys. So I'm going to become, you know, one of the best shots in my platoon. I'm going to be the fastest runner in my platoon. I'm going to be the best performer at this. And I just said, look, if they're going to keep me on that rung, they're going to have to respect that I outperform them. And in the end, they did. And so, you know, that broke down that barrier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I could see how breaking down a barrier like that through throwing yourself into your work, you know, in this case, becoming the best shot, the fastest runner, the best at whatever drills or exercises that you're participating in, right? That has some positive implications. Obviously, being a good shot as a Navy SEAL is going to be important. You know, being a fast runner and being, you know, top physical condition, all of those things have positive implications. But it also might take away from other things going on in your life as well. So, you know, becoming a workaholic is not necessarily advisable, you know, 100% of the time. Yeah, sure. Being good at your job is important, but when that's, you know, working and working at getting better at all these things, it may not be, you know, the best for it, you know, looking at your life holistically, looking at the big picture, you know, that may not be the best thing. And so I kind of want to get into, you know, some of the techniques that you developed through your own healing. You know, maybe it was after this, maybe it was during, I'm not sure exactly when you kind of discovered that there needed to be some sort of change.
Talk
about some of that stuff.
Yeah, the need for a change. Look, I wasn't a guy that was looking to change the world or add good value in that way and help people heal. And that I was, you know, really focused on the things that I wanted for myself in terms of recognition and value. And fortunate for me, I got a DUI. And when you get a DUI and they take your car and they impound it and they take your license and they restrict it for, you know, 18 months and they force you to go to these like classes or, you know, to get an education on alcoholism and, you know, the effects of drinking and driving, all that stuff, then you have to take like a good look in the mirror.
Mm-hmm.
Because now I have to ask other people for a ride to school every day. Because I got class Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. And now I got to ride the bus. So the universe is saying, look, if you can't get your act together, then you don't get to have the mobility and the fluidity that other people get to have when they move around the world. And so that's something when I look back upon my story was a really big wake up call. And then when you're sitting inside of a jail cell, right? And there's that stark contrast. It's, I don't know, 1 o'clock in the morning. There's five guys sitting across from me that are in the drunk tank with me, but they're wasted. I popped 0.08. The cops could have followed me home, which was like maybe 500 yards. Okay. Or they could have taken me to the drunk tank, and it was actually two ex-Marines. And they took me to the drunk tank. And thank goodness they did, because that is what really changed my reality. And then I called a family member. I let them know what happened. And I asked them if anybody else in our family had had those problems. And they sort of just sort of laughed. Like, you know, everyone in the family is an alcoholic. You didn't understand that because you're in boarding school. And the only time you saw us was at family functions. So you just assumed that we were only drinking then. But no, we were always drinking. And then I got to really deal with that. You know, when you go to AA and you're in this 12-step program for, you know, 5 or 6 months, you know, you start to understand, and you got to see these guys, which I was really young, but you see these guys that are 50 and 60 and they're, you know, they just, on the break, you know, they're pounding two cups of coffee and smoking cigarettes the whole time. And you're looking at them, you're like, wow, these guys are really beat up.
Yeah.
And I thought, no, I definitely don't want to go down that road. So I just decided to call everyone up who I was participating with in the party scene. And I said, look, if you're calling me because you want to get drunk or you want to go hang out and get wild, lose my phone number. Right. But if you're calling me up because you want a barbecue, you know, watch a football game, go to a Padres baseball game, come over to your house and help you move your furniture or help you in some way, cool, call me. But if it's not about that, then I'm no longer going to be coming over.
Right.
And guess what? Ask me, did anyone ever call me back?
I'm going to guess no.
No,
no,
no.
I was like the
mayor of San Diego. Like, I was like fully engrossed in the scene, and then suddenly I was gone.
Yeah.
And so I think the first step that I took was abstinence.
Mm-hmm.
Abstinence from sex, abstinence from alcohol, abstinence from nicotine, abstinence from Motrin, painkillers, abstinence, literally from everything. And then I started to just get honed in on getting healthy.
Okay. So that honing in on getting healthy, obviously you hit that moment, that realization that something needs to change, and you're ready to make a radical change, even if that meant, you know, deleting all these numbers from your phone book, or you know, telling people, hey, this is just not for me anymore. And I don't think that that's a problem, that you tell people, hey, I'm looking to make some positive changes in my life. And if you're not on board with that, forget I exist. You know, that type of message going to those people. You know, I think that there's not a problem with that necessarily, because if you have people in your life who are not on board with you doing something bigger, better, getting healthier, not, you know, wasting your life away, potentially getting to a point where you're going to hurt yourself or somebody else with, you know, driving drunk or something like that. If you got people in your life who have a problem with you bettering yourself, then I'm not so sure that you can actually put that label of a friend on there. You know, acquaintance, sure, yeah, but you know, friend, I don't know. You know, and so maybe that's that wake up call that you, it's like, you know what, maybe I need to get into a different environment, a different atmosphere with different people who are going to encourage that, even if it's, hey, maybe it's just me right now, and I'm on my own, and I'm going to do it myself. But then eventually you start attracting those people who are, you know, going to be a positive influence in your life. You know, I've had guests on this show before who were in similar situations, whether it was alcohol or drugs or, you know, other negative influences in their life. And it all was just a matter of their environment. It wasn't something that they necessarily wanted to do. It's just everybody who was around them was doing it. And so when they were doing it, they wanted to do it. And it just made it that much harder to walk away from it.
That dynamic, I think, solidified my ability to no longer overadapt, mm-hmm. which I think probably that was one of my strategies that I use, overrelate and overadapt and overadjust my personality in order to be part of the group of what's going on. And, you know, when you're growing up in a boarding school, you know, you're universal in the sense, because the boarding school that I went to had, you know, we had kids from every race. Okay. And we're all living together. And so you're forced to overadapt. And it wasn't something that I volunteered for. I didn't want to go to boarding school. That's where my grandmother wanted to send me, because I don't think she thought she had the energetic capacity
mm-hmm.
to raise a few boys. And so that was going to be a better dynamic for her. And I know for sure that getting that DUI definitely forced me to, like, imagine you have a pegboard and there's the center hole in the pegboard. I needed to figure out how to stay in that hole and no longer over-adapt or over-adjusted to social or environmental norm, and really figure out, like, what really worked for me. And that was huge. And then the next step was I was training hardcore, set a new goal to get to the Olympic trial. I think it was a bit of a fantasy, but I put in the hard work and the commitment just like I did in SEAL training. So I basically turned track and field into SEAL training. But you can't approach track and field like you would approach SEAL training. You need rest. And I didn't understand that. I took on the old idea, the old adage that, you know, you just work hard and your dreams will come true. Mm-hmm. And I found out that, well, actually, that's not true, right? You've got to work really smart and you need to really understand, like, what your limitations are. And part of my healing process and growth process was ascending out of limiting beliefs like the ones that I picked up in SEAL training. Like, if you're in pain and you don't mind, well, it doesn't matter. Just keep moving forward. Well, that's totally a limiting belief. Mm-hmm. That's great for training in the field. Like, yeah, you get shot, you better keep moving, because if you don't, you're going to die, right?
Right.
I don't think that I, at the time, was able to adjust how I was doing things, because I was taking on whatever I was doing as an identity. And when you take on an identity, the identity now influences you into the next stage that you're in, because you can't leave the identity behind.
Right.
And so it took me a while to realize that, you know, SEAL training is a painful experience. And so pain had become a very normal thing for me to feel in terms of, like, intensity. And so I didn't know how to turn that off and be able to exercise and move my body in a way that was functional and healthy. I only had one speed: go hard all day long until you fall down and then get back up.
Yeah. You know, when you're talking about your kind of adaptability to the different scenarios that you found yourself in, different groups of people that you're around. You know, you're talking before you were in the SEAL team, you were not a drinker. But then you kind of adapted this identity of well, I'm a Navy SEAL. I'm hanging out with Navy SEALs doing Navy SEAL things. I'm training.
You work harder and play harder.
You work hard, you play hard, you go out and you party and you drink, and that's just what it is, what it means to be a Navy SEAL, kind of in your mind, right? I'm not suggesting that that is what everyone has to kind of adapt to necessarily, yeah. but in your mind, that kind of was like, well, this just goes hand in hand with what it means to be a Navy SEAL.
This is just the environment,
yeah,
that we're in, and this is how we do things.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so, to my point before, when you're in that environment and this is just how things are and this is how people operate, well, okay, well, I'm just going to adapt to that scenario and let's not rock the boat and suggest that we do something else other than what everyone else wants to do, you know, and try to do something like that. So it kind of makes sense how you got to where you were in terms of, getting that DUI and having all those issues that go along with drinking in excess and doing things that, were not really you. It wasn't part of your personality and who you are, but it was you adapting to that situation. And so you figured out that, okay, now these things need to change, right? And you've utilize various techniques, and now going forward, you're also helping other folks, through some of the stuff that you've learned. And I know you've studied a range of different medical practices and different sciences and things like that. Talk to us about how the different methodologies and approaches that you've studied kind of shape your approach to, you know, overall wellness, longevity, well-being, all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I think probably the first thing that the listener needs to know is that by a certain age, I was suffering from debilitating states of pain and discomfort. So when you have pain all the time, you can deal with a certain amount, but once it got into the center of my hip, I couldn't get away from it. There was no reprieve. And so I had to figure out how to get out of this discomfort. And the only option that was going to be offered to me were painkillers and possibly a hip replacement. And I was like, no, this doesn't make sense to me. I didn't have any physical pain one day, and then the next day I had a lot of pain. So I was on the journey of figuring out how to transform my pain into pleasure. And I studied with a lot of people and picked up lots of bits of information, and I got to figure out really quickly what works and what doesn't work for my type of body and the type of stress, the complex stress that I was dealing with. So because I drove this, my engine so hot, I needed things that had greater force to them. And most of the stuff that was out there when I got started was barely hitting the surface. And it wasn't until I really started to dig in and really remove these deep layers, you know, surface, medium, and deep layers of tension and stress and emotional and structural distortion out of my body, that I got to sort of be fully planted in the center of the pegboard and unwilling to overadapt or overadjust, and really clear on what my values are and honoring my values every day. So to answer your question in regards to what tools did I use in order to get out of the debilitating states of pain and discomfort that I was in, the first was getting into juicing, right? Juicing and wheatgrass mixed with yoga. I wasn't getting very far in yoga because I had so much tension in my body. I could barely get into the positions that they were in. And that was just confusing. I could see these people crossing their arms over each other, doing these little movements, and I was as stiff as a board. And so I just kind of was like, in class, they're touching the ground. I'm not even three quarters of the way down. And that was humbling. And then I started to get into things like, you know, hot yoga. So maybe the heat will help. But while I was in class, it was good. But as soon as I cooled down, I was frozen again. And then I got into meditation, Feldenkrais, the Gosku method, Heller work, Rolfing, like anyone who knew anything, I wanted their help. And look, they got me down the road a little bit, but if I needed to go a mile, they took me an inch. And I kept praying every day, like, God, like, you must have created someone that knows more than all of these people. Come on, tell me you did. Okay. Like, I can't be sitting here suffering. And when you get even a little bit of relief, you start to feel that stress calm down a little bit. You start to feel more like yourself. You're happy for that little bit. Like, believe me, I wasn't complaining at the time. This is in retrospect of like, wow, I spent a lot of money and a lot of time working my body through systems that never were able to answer the call. And then I met this guy from an email that a buddy of mine that I, of course, went to boarding school with, came out, spent a couple of weeks with me. He went home and then he sent me an email, said, hey, look, I saw this guy in Good Morning America. He's got 5 stretches that'll change your life. I was like, you should take these stretches and you should go change your life. Like, who the hell are you to be telling me I'm going to change my life? Like, that's the attitude I had then. And then 3 weeks later, One of my clients called me, this anesthetician, and she said, look, I just saw this guy in Good Morning America. Now, I know my grandmother liked Good Morning America, and I would watch morning TV with her, and you would never see the same person on two times in 3 weeks.
Right.
So I said, there must be something here. So I went and I investigated and I found the guy. It took me about 6 months to track him down. And then he taught me how to use eccentric contractions and isometric contractions to remove structural tension from the belly of the muscle. And it was very uncomfortable. Yet afterwards, I would, every time he would do some work on me, I would laugh like a hyena for like 10, 15 minutes. And it was like uncontrollable laughter, right? And I'm just like laughing and laughing and laughing and laughing and laughing. And then we'd go into another position and he would take more stress out of there. And this went on for 4 days straight, like maybe a few hours in the afternoon break. But it was like 6.5 to 8 hours a day that this was going on. And he's standing on me and in all these weird positions. And to make a long story short, I flew back to San Diego from San Jose and I got on the plane. Well, when I went to the airport, people suddenly were bumping into me and I never had anyone bumping into me. And if I was going to grab my bag, whoever was behind me, they just got out of my way. Right. But now that's not happening anymore. And I went to sit down on the flight and I put my arm here on the armrest. And the guy was kind of like pushing my arm off the armrest. I was like, what is going on? And so it didn't dawn on me still what was going on. And then people were wanting to like talk to me. What are you doing? I was like, what is happening? Because, you know, when you go through SEAL training, you're in a SEAL team, do you have like this supreme level of focus and intensity? And if people aren't on that vibe, they find you intimidating.
Mm-hmm.
And so they just want to get out of your way. Like they don't know what you're on. But they know that you're on something that they've never been on, and that makes them feel unsafe. And suddenly people didn't feel unsafe anymore. Well, I went back and I taught my Wednesday night women's class in the Bay in San Diego, this place called De Anza Cove. And I walk up and I said, hey, tonight we're going to figure out what you want to do for class. So why don't you take 15 minutes to warm up and come back? We'll get started. And they were all looking at me like, where's Christopher? Like, who? Where is my drill sergeant? Like, where is my Navy SEAL? Like, who is this putz asking me what I want, right? Instead of telling me what I need.
Sure.
And at the end of that class, I basically had the insight and I said, look, whatever we were doing before, I'm not going to do that anymore. Whatever that guy was doing to me this last 4 days, that's what I'm going to be doing. And that's when everything really, really shifted. Well, on my ride home, I didn't even know that I was being different because the way that my mind worked, it worked in a retroactive state. So I would go through an experience and then either hours or days or weeks later, I would realize what the experience was about.
Oh.
Because my emotional body was so activated. I was never allowed to process in the moment because I had such a backlog of tension and stress that was keeping my emotional body from processing decades of experiences. Well, I got home and I called him up and I was like, I don't know what's going on, but let me tell you what happened to me at the airport. Let me tell you what happened with the armrest. Let me tell you what happened. People bumping into me all the time. I don't know what's going on, but these are the things that are changing. So something is happening emotionally and psychologically. And he just started laughing. He was like, just tell me more. So every day I would go through, I'd take more tension out of my body in the way that he was teaching me. And I would have a completely new experience of myself. But the experience that I was having was my old self before I went to SEAL training. I was in the SEAL team. And it was like every day I was getting a little bit more of me back and a little bit more of me back and a little bit more of me back. And I went after it 5-6 hours a day on doing this work on myself. And then I recruited friends of mine to come in and figure out how we could do the work on each other and make it more impactful. And so these techniques and these processes, I just got totally focused on. And I basically turned heel training, you know, SEAL training and the heel training. And I got down every day. And then I started using other people as guinea pigs, right, to test my ideas out. And it was producing verifiable, repeatable results regardless of the person. They were all having the same experiences.
You know, I like the what you were saying about how you get back to that person before joining the Navy. You know, who were you before back then? Because a lot
lighthearted, silly, funny guy, you know, just going with the flow, open-hearted, compassionate, understanding for everyone's circumstances, never judgmental, never critical. Just very open and smooth.
Yeah. And for the people who have never served, sometimes the idea that veterans have trouble adjusting to civilian life, that concept is hard for some people to understand, because it's like, well, you were a civilian before, just go back to being that person who you were before. But you get so tied up in this, the training changes you, your identity changes, you're a Navy SEAL and you do Navy SEAL things, and or you're a soldier, or you're a Marine, or you're an airman, whatever it is, your job is you do that, and you're now, you've changed, you've transformed yourself into this person that you realistically you had to be in order to do your job effectively. That's what basic training does. It molds you into what the military needs you to be. Yeah. And it kind of says, you know, forget about who you were. This is who you are now. And then when you get out, and the military does a great job, by the way, of transforming you into this warrior that you need to be while you're in the military. But when you get out, they do a terrible job at transforming you back into a civilian.
Yeah. And 1000%.
And what you were just saying is you got to kind of get in touch with that person who you were and let some of that person come back in. And obviously you have your Navy SEAL experiences. That's always going to be a part of who you are. But that's not.
But it's not a driver of my personality. Meaning,
sure,
it no longer. I don't hold myself to a standard of performance. I hold myself to a standard of being.
Right.
And I'm only going to be whatever the moment needs me to be, and however, you know, God or the universe or infinite source is directing me, and it's got to come from my heart, and it can't come from some identity.
Right. And the Navy SEAL identity, it no longer serves you as who you are, you know, right? No. And so, of course, it's part of your past, and you're not going to deny any of that past, right? But it doesn't serve you any longer to continue being that drill sergeant kind of person, or that very militant, very intensely focused, heavily you know, nobody wants to approach you. Nobody wants to question you if you're taking the armrest on the airplane or anything like that. It doesn't serve you anymore to be that type of person. And so now getting back in touch with that person that you once were,
is freedom.
It's freedom. Yeah. It's a good thing. Right.
Yeah.
Now for some people, they may feel a little scared by that because they didn't like the person that they were before the military, and the military gave them the discipline and things like that. It's not saying that you can't take those bits and pieces that worked for you and hang on to those things. You know, maybe you weren't structured and had discipline before. Like, you were in boarding school, you had plenty of that. Yeah. So you didn't need more of it, right?
No, but I didn't need more of that. I didn't need more structure. I needed like less structure.
Right, right. Yeah. And so for some people, they need the structure, right? But it doesn't mean that you can't hang on to those pieces.
Yeah, it's just... and I think the thing that the listener needs to understand is what I'm saying is I was able to shed all the things that were no longer of benefit to me.
Yeah, right.
All the goodness I got from SEAL training and SEAL teams, I've kept all of that, right? So I know I'm self-motivated. I'm articulate, I'm direct, I'm mission oriented. I'm doing it from a different place. I'm doing it from a place of my heart. and honoring my values rather than honoring their values.
Right.
Right. And the values that you pick up when you're in the SEAL team, I got completely different values. And those were the values that were innate to me before I went to SEAL training and was in the SEAL teams.
100%. Yeah. So the work you do now, and I don't know if I mentioned this in the intro or not, and I probably should have. This might have been a miss on my part, but True Body Intelligence. Tell us about that and what that's all about and how you work with folks to help them out.
Yeah, I think recently I was in a conversation with someone. And if you think about True Body Intelligence, is a system that helps you diminish stress, emotional stress, physical stress. You know, when you're an athlete, you're under physical stress, right? Mm-hmm. When you're a mom, you're under emotional stress. You know, when you're a CEO, you're under financial stress, right? You're under system stress. You know, when you're part of a community, you're under religious stress, right? There's all these levels of complex stress. And so True Body Intelligence is a system that allows you to reduce those levels of stress by at least 50%, right? And imagine if you could take everyone and anyone you've ever known and you could reduce their lifetime accumulated stress load by 50%. Well, their vision would get better. Their hearing would get better. Their smell, their taste, their touch, their awareness of boundaries would increase. And so what I mean by that is their body becomes more intelligent, right? And so stress basically makes your body dumb.
Okay.
And how do you know your body's dumb? You have pain. Because if it was intelligent, well, we know if you're maximized in the intelligence in your body, you'd have a body full of pleasure. Now, I don't really care about people getting the pleasure. That's not a driver to me. But for people to get to neutrality, where they might not have pleasure, but they don't have pain, mm-hmm. right? I think that's a good safe space to get into, because in neutrality, you're never able to over-adjust or over-adapt, because you just simply see things as they are. You add nothing and you take nothing away. You're in touch with reality rather than some projected fantasy that you've created around your identity that you think you need to uphold in order to be acceptable, in order to be loved.
Okay.
And so the focus of True Body Intelligence is to help people reduce that lifetime accumulated stress load and then to teach them positive stress management strategies and tools so they can manage their daily accumulated stress. Now, daily accumulated stress is very different than lifetime accumulated stress, because it's what you've accumulated in the 24-hour period that your sleep was unable to resolve. So insufficient sleep means that you carry Monday stress into Tuesday morning, right? Mm-hmm. Well, I created a term to be able to make people begin to understand the difference between stress and trauma, okay? And what I created, I said, okay, let's take those two words, cut them in half and splice them together. And I created a word called trauma.
Okay.
And what that is stress that accumulates over time. Once it gets to a certain level, it has the same exact impact on you as trauma. And so most humans, you know, haven't been something as been through something as traumatic and, demanding a SEAL training or the SEAL teams or some childhood trauma. Maybe your dad walks out when you're 6 years old, or your mom is screaming and yelling all the time at your father. You know, just those dynamics that go up, that you grow up under in your environment. Maybe they grew up and mom and dad got along great and da 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 da. But let's say they had they had a kid that criticized them in school here and there. They had a teacher that picked on them a little bit or embarrassed them. And now each day they overadapt a little more and they overadjust a little bit out of their own personality. Well, that's stressful to your brain because your brain only wants you to be yourself.
Got it. Yeah.
And as you get into these strategies of overadapting and overadjusting, the end result of that is you accumulate more stress because you're not being authentic. So the greatest producer of stress in anyone's life is inauthenticity.
I can see kind of what you were talking about earlier, where when you first discovered some of the stuff that was helping you in your journey, that you were dealing with a backlog of stress, right?
Yes.
From years and years of
decades.
Decades of stress that was just accumulated within you, so that you couldn't process the daily stuff because you're still that was like, you know, take a number, get to the end of the line, kind of thing, right? Because I'm still dealing with 10 years ago stuff, you know, 20 years ago stuff. We'll get to you later, you know, and that just adds to the overall stress, and that ends up never really getting resolved because, you know, for those little daily things that happen, that you're not dealing with, if it never gets resolved, it gets pushed to the back of the line, and you're sitting there, you know, basically saying to yourself, "I'll deal with that later," but you're not going to remember that 5 years from now when it gets to the front of the line. You're not going to remember it that well that you're going to be able to deal with it as effectively as you would, you know, today.
Yeah. And you're not going to remember it cognitively, but your body's going to remember because it's still sitting in there.
Right. Yeah. So it's not going to be as effective as if you're just like, hey, you know what, let's right here, right now, let's deal with this and let's figure out what's going on. And let's file this one away and get move on from this. Right.
Yeah. And think about it, pain and discomfort and confusion and anxiety and anger and fear, they're the last indicators that something is wrong. Hmm. Most people think that they're the first. So when you get into a perpetual or a semi-chronic or chronic state of anxiety, it means that something's been going on for decades, for a very long time, that now your body said, look, I got to remind you every single day that something's wrong. Mm-hmm. And so, okay, I need to turn up the anxiety. Oh, you're not getting it. Let me turn it up to 60% now. Oh, you're still not getting it. You're not taking action to help me. Okay, we're going to turn that up to 85%. And so the thing about the body that, you know, I want the vets to understand is that whatever's in your body is in your life. And so if you have pain in your body, whether your neck is stiff or your shoulder's stiff, your hip is stiff or your knees are stiff or you're an insomniac, or, you know, you need to, the only tools you have access to manage your stress load or marijuana and alcohol and caffeine, you know, all of these are signs. These are like flashing red lights on the dash of your car that's telling you your engine is too hot and you're losing water and your oil is too low. And so when you have that first indicator goes off like bah, 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 and you got shoulder pain, you need to use your mind to go, okay, so I have shoulder pain and I heard from Christopher that when I have pain, that pain is the last indication that something is wrong and it's not the first. Oh, what's been going on in my life for the last 6 months that I've been avoiding? Because usually it's an avoidance of some issue with your identity and a reluctance to be authentic in yourself. And you need to then, once you make that decision to resolve your shoulder or your sleep issues or your alcoholism or your public fighting, like whatever it is, once you make that decision, you have to go through your history with a fine-tooth comb. Mm-hmm. And you need to go, okay, well, what's this about? Oh, yeah. So mom, how was dad treating you the first 5 years of my life? Well, your dad, you know, you kids didn't know him then, but he was mean and he was nasty and he was passive aggressive and he was screaming and yelling because children adults had maybe one or two subconscious precognitive memories, but they don't remember the real environment and the interpersonal dynamics that were going on that caused them to overadjust and overadapt out of their authentic personality to take on a negatively conditioned personality that would be acceptable to the parent. And so when we look at stress and we look at tension and we look at emotional and structural and psychological distortion, the biggest factor of that is subconscious precognitive function from womb to seven and unconscious precognitive imprints from 7 to 13. And mostly when I'm working, when I'm using these tools and I'm working with someone, I'm really looking at their lifetime accumulated stress load. But then on the fifth day, because I spend 5 days with people, on the fifth day, I teach them systems that they can use to deal with their daily accumulated stress, take all of that out every day, and then take a little bit of the big piece of pie, take a little tiny bit of that out, and then every day, they're getting a little better. Mm-hmm. Their vision's increasing, their hearing's getting better, their sleep is getting better, their communication is getting better, their sense of who it is they are, their unwillingness to overadapt and overadjust is getting better, and they're getting really, really clear on what their own sense of values are. And when you're honoring your particular set of values every day, you're building self-esteem. And then once you have self-esteem, you don't need identity anymore, because identity is only an interference to your authenticity.
Gotcha. Well, I think there's probably some listeners out there who are thinking to themselves, yeah, this guy might be onto something here, and I might need some work in this area, of my life. Where can people go to find out more information about what you do, and maybe to reach out and see if they can't get some help from you, or
That's easy. I'm all over YouTube. Like, I do tons of podcasting. I'm interviewed by a lot of people. Everyone have a slightly different angle, so we give slightly different information each time. They can go to truebodyintelligence.com, right? There's enough information there to lead you to the book. I suggest you read the book. If you don't like reading, most people have shifted to listening to books these days. Mm-hmm. And so the book is on audio on my website at truebodyintelligence.com. Download that, and it's easy. You're just going to email my assistant, assist.rit@gmail.com. And then once you're done reading the book, she'll set us up on a call, and the call's free. I'll spend 30 minutes to an hour helping you create some strategies that will create a successful pattern interrupt from the things that you're suffering from. Right. So because I've had basically all of them grouped together at one time or another. And if you're financially challenged, I will figure out strategies that you can use that don't cost you any money. Right. So you don't have to look at me like, well, this guy's all over the internet and he's got a book and it's going to be expensive. I can't afford him or blah, blah. Like, forget all that. I will figure out a way to get you to some tools that will be able to add good value to you. And I will only lead you to tools that I used myself.
Excellent. And I know there's people out there who are probably resonating. This message is resonating with them. So I want to encourage them to, follow those links. And I'll put these links in the show notes. For the mm-hmm. listeners, make it super easy for you to find all this too.
And I forgot one. People are into like the quicker ones. If you go to like TikTok or Instagram, I always leave like a 25 or 30 second download about some aspect of stress or some new perspective that you could take or some action that you could take. And you go to Christopher Lee Maher, M-A-H-E-R, at Instagram, and you go to Christopher Lee Maher on TikTok. Okay. If you go to Facebook, True Body Intelligence. If you go to YouTube, True Body Intelligence. You go to my website, True Body Intelligence.
Excellent. And again, I'll put all of these links in there in the show notes too for folks. So regardless of where you want to consume the content, whether it's, you know, TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, wherever, you'll be able to grab those links from the show notes and make it super easy to get in touch there. But I do want to thank you, Christopher, really for sharing your techniques and your story, really, because I think the story is important to share that, you know, hey, you were there too. You had these issues.
Yeah.
Didn't know really why they were happening or how you got there, but it's like, I know something needs to change.
Yeah.
And sharing that journey towards, you know, a better life and better health, helping folks find that for themselves as well, I think is important too. And I want to thank you for not only your service, but the work that you continue to do in helping people, I think is super important. And thank you for taking the time to come on the show and share this message with us.
Thank you. I've loved every second. I'm happy to serve. And look, man, you know, I think as you get older, and I think you'll probably resonate with this, what you really care about is service and adding good value to other people's lives. Because what is more, for me, you know, there's nothing more important than that.
Right.
And, you know, once you have a home that you like to live in and you have an established professional life that you enjoy and love, well, now you have time. How am I going to spend my time? Like, this is the prudent action to honor what I believe I was created for, which is to add positive value to other people's lives.
And one of the most valuable things that I think anybody has is their time. And
yeah,
when you are able to give some of that time to help out other people, I feel like, yes, it doesn't give you more time back, obviously, but it gives you, pays you back in ways that financially doesn't compute. It's better than financial gain. Obviously, like you said, you need to have that stability, that security, you know, a house that you know you're secure in, and you know have a job that puts money in the bank. But when you're able to give back to other people, you know, that just means so much, and it feels so great. And so you know, I 100% agree with what you're just saying there. So
yeah, well, look, thank you too for doing what you're doing. We need more people like you that are interviewing people like me and getting good information and tools out to people who are in a difficult place. Mm-hmm. And maybe all they're looking for is a little bit of hope. Maybe they're looking for a tool. Maybe they're looking for a book, like whatever they're looking for. You know, you're taking the time out of your day to provide at least an opportunity. And I think that's awesome.
100%. Thank you so much for that. And for the listeners, again, check out the show notes, get all those links, and go check out what Christopher has to offer. Thanks again.